I am in the home of Harriet Friedman, 176 Robert Street. And first thing I want to say is, Harriet, thank you very much for giving me your time.
My pleasure.
My first question is, would you tell me when you moved to Robert Street, south of Harvard, and what stage of your life that has been? Because then that'll determine the kinds of questions I'll ask.
Right. Yeah. Well, I was in a relationship and renting, and I was just finishing my, no, I had finished my PhD, so I'd been renting, we had been renting an apartment on Madison Avenue, and I was commuting to my first job, which was in London, University of Western Ontario. And I finished my thesis while I was doing that, which was kind of crazy, but I did do it. And then I resigned, and I got a job at U of T. And while all that was going on, I also got a postdoc to go to England, which was great. And my partner at the time got a sabbatical, so we went off. So we bought this house, and even before move at that phase, you know, so it was just the beginning of my career. Really at U of T, and which has been very convenient, I must say. I mean, if nothing else, and so we lived here for just a few months while we were doing some early renovations, just a bathroom and bedroom. It had been a rooming house upstairs. Now there was a Greek family that lived on the main floor. I don't even know how many of them there were, but they lived on the main floor, and they rented out rooms upstairs. So there was a kitchen on the second floor, and three bedrooms, and a tiny bathroom. And on the third floor, also using that bathroom, it's the only one, were two more rooms, and tiny, and a kitchen. So there were three kitchens.
And one bathroom.
And one... No, well, there was...
Oh, there was a bathroom on...
No, not on this floor. But there was a bathroom in the basement.
So the Greek family could use the bathroom in the
basement. In the basement. And, I suppose, and also in the basement were lots and lots of electrical outlets and shelves. It was a garment workshop.
Oh.
Yeah.
So they had an industry going on. Well, a business going on here.
I think the women, at least the main, the wife, you know, mother, wife, didn't speak English. And I don't, so she just, I know from Laura Johnson's work on outsourcing in Toronto, homework, that this was a fairly common pattern, that immigrant women would work at home and not learn English, and it probably suited patriarchal families as well as exploitative businesses to do that.
So you're saying that there were probably a number of women who came here to work with all those electrical outlets.
Well, there were several people. I imagine there were several people working, but I don't know if they might have been part of the family.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I don't know what relationship.
Well, we usually kind of talk about a cottage industry.
Yeah.
There was certainly work happening at 176 Robert Street.
Absolutely, yeah. And they were putting together an income by renting out rooms and squeezing themselves into the first floor. So we reduced the density hugely.
And that was in 1977?
Yes.
So it was you and your partner, your daughter, was she still here at the time?
Oh, my daughter hadn't been born yet.
Oh, she hadn't been born yet?
She hadn't been conceived. She hadn't even been thought about.
Okay, so
she was born in 1985.
Okay, so at that time there were two of you.
Two of us
and 12 of you.
Yeah, he was divorced though, so his three children would come and stay,
mm-hmm.
You know, like days at a time, mm-hmm. on a regular set of schedule.
Okay, so that's interesting. It was clear to you that work had been going on downstairs with all those outlets. When you moved in here,
that was Greek, by the way. I don't know if I said.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So you moved in here, since it had been a boarding house, it had been crowded with people. Let's just move into the area of the changes you made and how you made them through the years.
Oh, my. I guess I used to answer the phone, Our Lady of Perpetual Renovations. It's like put in walls I've taken out and taken out walls I put in and stuff like that. Okay, the first thing we did was we made a bedroom and enlarged the bathroom on the second floor. And when Jack's sons would come to stay, they stayed on the third floor. And I kind of liked it up there. There was that kitchen. We didn't take that out for a while. Then when he and I separated, I needed to buy him out his share of the house, and I didn't really have the money to do that. So I borrowed it, actually from friends, second mortgage, and I divided the house in two at that point. And I rented it. I put a wall in where the stairs are, so they were self-contained.
Now, what did you use? What space did you use?
I used the second and third floor. Okay. So you would enter the front door. Mm-hmm. These walls have been taken out since, right? You would enter, there was a door here to the living room and a door to the dining room. Mm-hmm. And I just closed off the hallway there. So you would enter this first floor like this, mm-hmm. and use all of it in the basement. That's where the bathroom was.
So they used the first floor and the basement.
Yes.
And you had the second and the third floor. So you each had good space.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. So there were three bedrooms on the second floor, and then the living, we made a nice kitchen. We just renovated the kitchen that was already there on the third floor, and that became the open plan living room, dining room, kitchen area on the third floor with a little deck outside. So yeah, it was quite nice, actually. And so I rented that out, and then, there were a whole lot of, it was a feminist theater company that was headed down here. And
Women. They had?
No, they wasn't the company, no, right. Just the people, just the director.
Oh, those were some of your tenants.
Tenants, yeah, yeah. There were. Kind of middle class. They were gentrifying mm-hmm. people too. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were not like the Greeks who lived here before, right?
Yeah. And, so, and you weren't renting it just rooms from people.
No. It was an apartment.
Right.
Yeah. It was an apartment, and and at one point somebody had a baby while they were here, so they moved out eventually. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anything in particular in terms of heating? Did you modify that, or was that already the way it is now?
No, it's the way it is now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I put in new furnaces.
Yeah,
I don't know how many.
Yeah.
And when I get to the next one, I'll connect it to my solar hot water, which I eventually put in like recently.
So this has had a number of incarnations.
Oh,
since 1977.
Oh, yeah.
What year was this house built? Do you have any idea?
Oh, yes, they told me, because somebody did the survey and they gave me a little booklet, but I don't know where it is. I think they said 1920-ish, something mm-hmm. like that. I would have thought it was older because not because I did any research, this is all practical experience, because I've taken out some walls, like things to do with the center wall, and there's just wood slats in there, and the code after the Great Fire of the 1890s sometime that built Bird Robart's library and a lot of the houses around here meant that that wasn't legal anymore, but they could have done it illegally later, mm-hmm. or It survived the fire. And there's that kind of slap between the two chimneys, too, of the attached house, mm-hmm. which got me quite distressed at one point when I found that out, because bricks were falling down on my side, so I figured they were falling down on the other side, too. But the German couple next door lost their English whenever I wanted to talk about anything to do with our two houses. So that was it.
So you did not have an easy relationship with your neighbors when there was anything important to discuss.
No, even not. Even other times, no. I would say not.
Well, let's move on to that since we're talking
about
neighbors and the neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
Since 1977, Can you describe who made up the neighborhood in 77 and now we're 2013?
Oh, right. Well, this little area right here mm-hmm. is surprisingly stable.
This area being Harbor?
No, just the five or six houses that are on either side or across the street. So, I forget the numbers because they're so different on the...
Yeah, they're not coordinated north, east and west.
They're not. So, yeah, I see it now. It's 125, uh-huh. Italian family, same ones. I've watched the little girl grow up. I've watched the old lady die, you know, and Sylvia Peretta across the street. Lena, her daughter, and my daughter were in utero at the same time, you know. So, you know, I can't remember exactly if some of these, but I think all of them were here. Josephine next door to Sylvia, I think, was also here.
So that's they're Italian, all these people.
No, Josephine is not, okay. And Sylvia's not, but Nick, her husband was. And yes, and of course, Peretta Pizza was the origin of Nick, and Mario still lives up above. Peretta
Pizza. I
remember
Mario because, of course, I lived on Robert Street and I knew Mario and his restaurant.
I
interviewed
Mario. Oh, that's old Mario. This is young Mario.
Young Mario,
yeah. So he's living upstairs.
But generally speaking, what are the changes that you've seen? How was it in around 77 and 80 and now in 2013? Is that something you can discuss? Or?
Well, I can. I mean, I guess I have this idea it's been gentrifying because that's supposedly what's happening, but what I'm saying is my experience just in this little area is it's not. And the people next door are Portuguese, and they've been here. They were here when I moved in, and they're now on their great-grandchildren. Right. Their grandchildren are the age of my daughter because they start earlier. The people next door are the only ones who sold. The German couple, they moved out and they were renting. The son had married a Filipino wife, and I think it was some of her relatives, anyway, some of her connections, who mainly were living there. They were lovely neighbors. And then they sold it like 3 years ago, so now it's become a rooming house, which is a real... Well, it's not a rooming house, sorry. It's not technically a rooming house, which is part of the problem. It's two apartments that are rented at such a high rate that they pack in lots of people who move through very quickly. So it's a real, real, real problem for me. And I think it actually for the neighborhood, because in addition to gentrification, that's the economics of that are incredible. He's charging $3,450 for the downstairs apartment.
And he's getting it.
I watched him interview people right now because he's finding new tenants for downstairs. And upstairs they're paying $3,000, but...
So he's getting $6,400 for those two floors?
Yeah, and he doesn't have any money to fix it up, so you can see how it looks. So we're in constant...
That's who you share a wall with right here. And he's getting so much money.
That the economics favor this now. And so he uses that money to buy more places because he's not using it to invest in the house, you know. So this is something people should know about, and I've been on it with Adam Vaughn's office, Tim's on it. There's several of these in the neighborhood. So that's
well, and we've discussed this kind of problem on the board.
I go to the board every way up to him. Yeah, look what's happening now, and you know, and there've been some pretty challenging people and incidents, you know, from the people downstairs.
Are some of them students or mostly they're not students?
They're both. Mm-hmm. You know, so the ones downstairs are not. They're self-described construction workers, but it's casual day labor, and really their hearts are in the heavy metal band that they have. Though they never play their music here. The most you get is this kind of deadening kind of strum practicing thing comes through the wall, but they don't play their music here because they've been evicted from other places, so they knew. But you know, these houses are not well built. So
I had my
first crisis when they moved in with smoke was filling up my house, tobacco smoke mainly, and so that was. But they stopped, and I expanded my acquaintanceship network. You know, I
developing a kind of way of talking with the main guy, and he just said, don't talk to anybody else, talk to me, ask for me, which is what I do, and they hop to and go get him, you know, but they're moving out. But the next people who've interviewed, I was just there when he was interviewing one on the street, and their students, but not everyone. It depends. It just depends.
And what's your experience when the students are there?
The students have been great who've moved in here. Mm-hmm. Now, I know their problems with noise and late hours and things in general, but I've just been incredibly lucky. Incredibly lucky. And I've had good relationships with them and worked with them on how to deal with the landlord. They have more rights than I do. So it's definitely been a project for me. If we want to control mice, if we want to deal with whatever it is, you know, that has to be dealt with. So I hope you're not going to actually write all this. Well, you can write it all up if you want. It's nothing I haven't told the landlord himself many times in writing and in...
But he's really a slum landlord.
Absolutely. And this is blockbusting, right? Yeah. Because if enough of it happens, the economics will lead to this kind of conversion. Because it's hard to stay next to that. And the people who want to buy are both kinds now. I mean, you can still, gentrifiers, or I see it, you know, they're happening all over. But this is the new trend.
You mean people buying to rent it out to as many people as possible?
Both things are happening. Yeah, yeah. Both gentrification, like people want to live in it like this, right? And this other one. And who knows? I have the slightest idea how that will play out.
But it's a serious concern.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So it's a new trend. But the old one, I guess a big, big, big deal around here in the old days was the Morgenthaler Clinic. So, we heard my daughter and her sleepover friend heard the explosion. They were little, I put up a film crew that was doing a documentary on the Morgenthaler Clinic here. That was kind of fun. They could actually run their cable from the back door to here somehow, and that was a big polarizing. That was the first of a number of polarizing issues in this neighborhood. Is that the sort of thing you're interested in?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so the person, I don't know if you remember, but I left out the house that's between 123 or 5, whatever, I can't see because of the leaf, and Sylvia Peretta. There's a house in between. There's a restraining order still on the people in that house from the Paredes, not for me.
Yeah.
The guy there was pretty violent, and he's dead now. But he's the one who attacked Morgenthaler with the garden shears. And then, you know, and there was a lot of, that was the most dramatic, but there was a lot of tension in the neighborhood because there were demonstrations on both sides at the Morgenthaler Clinic, and there were people who were very passionate on both sides, but especially the anti-abortionists, given the number of Catholics in the neighborhood. And it was extremely interesting for me because I could actually hear from neighbors like how they thought, like mm-hmm. what it was exactly.
So people they were got speaking them up because so they felt upset. That they were right.
Oh, yeah,
and
they'd be on the street,
it.
And yeah, you know. And then that was the first. And then a later one was the car thing. You've probably heard about that. The one-way system, the maze.
Talk about it, please.
And Nick Peretta was one of the ones really upset. So that was actually quite a funny story, which I don't think there's any problem telling. That we were thinking, you know, the neighborhood wanted some people, the Residents Association, Sarah Hasty was the president at that time, wanted to introduce a maze, and Olivia Chow was our city councilor, and she was open to it, and so there was this thing about did the neighborhood want it, and so we were going to do a petition. So I thought, what a great opportunity. My daughter was about 8 or 9. What a great opportunity to introduce her to civic life. I thought it was like a motherhood issue. I should have thought motherhood was very contentious in this neighborhood, and maybe the cars would be too. So, but I didn't think that. I just thought, well, it'd be like a fantasy of a motherhood issue, and I'll take her with me, and we'll go down the street and do the petition. So we started, and people just went ballistic. Some of them, I mean, some were fine, sign or not sign, but you know, but some people were just going absolutely ballistic. And I thought, the first one, well, okay, we got a strange neighborhood. We'll just go on, you know. But then we got a few, and I started realizing this was not the civic education I wanted to have for my daughter, and I really didn't know if the petition was going to work anyway. So,
but she was certainly seeing both sides of it.
Well, she was not, and it was so emotional that I'm not sure she was seeing there was opposition.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure she was, or I was, getting arguments. I mean, eventually I could listen better, and I could actually see in retrospect that some of the things they said would be confusing and so on were true, and especially on this block. Taxis will actually back up really fast because they can't figure out how to get in, you know?
Yeah. Coming in along Wilcox and going north or south, I know that's
So, I mean, they did have a point, but they were... I mean, there was such emotion behind it that it was actually hard to listen to the point. And maybe I was too polarized too, like too committed to calming traffic, you know, the people with the middle class people with the kids, basically.
It's not a one size fits all, and it's diverse. And even in this neighborhood where most of us are so happy to be, we still have to opposing opinions.
Absolutely. Not just opposing opinions, but as I'm saying, like real conflicts. Between the, including some violence, even, you know.
Related to some of these issues. Oh, well.
Well, this was that was the abortion thing. Yeah. So, you know, it's, you never know, right? No, the cars, as far as I know, produce no violence, except in rhetoric. it's been very, very interesting living here and learning a lot about how different classes and cultural groups see things. And I'm not 100% sure we've really learned, like those instances, if we've collectively learned how to listen better. You know what I mean? Like, to have these kind of dialogues better.
Well, and if people feel passionate, they don't necessarily want to listen.
That's the problem.
If you feel one way about abortion or another, or even the streets, zooming up and down.
Cars are very emotional to some people. This is what I learned. They are really emotional. And that is a marker, often, of class and culture.
Well, I remember,
and gender, of course.
But I remember when there was an issue about parking on Sundays here.
Uh-huh.
I was living here at that time.
Yeah.
Can we park on Sundays? All of us, I mean, just those of us who live here and have permits.
Right.
And there were some people who were very upset when we said, no, we want to keep it just for the people who live in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Because they have families coming to visit and that sort of thing.
But those of us who don't have families coming or just wanted to find parking.
Still want our car.
Okay, so you're talking about all these differences of opinion and people being hot-headed and passionate.
Uh-huh.
Generally speaking, what would you say about the safety of this neighborhood?
Oh, completely.
How it was?
Oh, completely safe. Completely safe. And it was such, and so well located for transport. So my daughter had so much more freedom than many other kids because she could go to the corner store. When that little children's bookstore, the Constant Reader, was there, she could, as a little, you know, I'd call them and say she's coming, and then she'd go and they'd call me and say she was there. She could read as long as she wanted. She didn't have to cross any streets, right? And then they'd call me and she'd come back, you know? And she could go to the corner store, which upset some of her visiting friends' parents, you know.
Because they didn't allow their children to go to stores
yet. Because they would be arriving home with something from the corner store, right? But it was completely safe. I mean, it was the Fudas in the corner store, and then it was the various Korean families
Fudas,
who taken
Johnny
over.
Fuda was my landlord all these years.
You told me! So, Johnny Fuda. I once asked him to help me break in because I'd locked myself out and I had to go to work. He said, "I won't do that." I said, "Oh, please. I can show you how." I got to go to work.
That's part of the neighborhood.
Absolutely.
You helped you break into your own home.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What about the other stores in the neighborhood? What? Now that
I watched some of the old Jewish stores leave, of course. You did too. Major Fish Market. Kalman's Kosher Chicken. Major Fish Market is where Olive and Lemon is now. Mm-hmm. Was. Mm-hmm. They never sold any fish, and they, as far as I could tell, they would have two pieces in there, and they were very grumpy when you went in. But that's where it was. Kalman's Kosher Chicken.
Where was that?
That was where the Pottery Place is now.
Oh.
The other, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the Harvard Bakery expanded and gentrified, basically. Adapted to the neighborhood, and it's much bigger, more than a bakery.
So there was more variety of stores in 1977 and 1980, the fish market, the chicken place.
Yeah, there were. Although I have to say I never shopped there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I tried the fish market, but I could never find anything to buy. And the chicken, I would go to Kensington Market. Has been such a boon. And I was just there this afternoon, right? Kensington Market keeps changing. It's amazing to me that it's been kept from the developers right there in the city. It's got such a strong community, and yet the community keeps evolving. The stores keep evolving. The last of the Jewish stores that I know of is gone. It was Max's, I think, on Baldwin. Baldwin, the cross street. It's mm-hmm. then it became the kind of really nice, more middle class butcher shop, which then moved in where European Meat used to be, and now that's a kind of sustainable fish store.
So all the Jewish stores have been replaced by others, as far as you can
tell. Except for Harvard Bakery.
Yeah.
And that's become multicultural too, because the Filipino family, that's part of it, they married into. So, yeah. So it's really
Those are Ruffy's sons. He adopted them.
Oh, he adopted them.
Yeah,
oh, I didn't know.
Sons,
I didn't know.
And he brought them up.
Oh,
he adopted each one when they were. Each one was about 10 years old. He went to the Philippines and brought Tully back, and then Daddy.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay. So thank you for telling me that. You just fill in the empty spaces with assumptions.
So you've used Kensington Market a lot, and you continue to use it.
Yeah.
So you've been here a lot of years.
Yeah.
Have you always used it in the same way? And if it's changed, in what ways has that changed for you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I joined Karma Co-op when my daughter went to Palmerston School. It was really convenient. Mm-hmm. Across the street. And I'm still a member, so I go there when I can. And, of course, the whole food scene has changed so much, and I've been part of that. I'm on the Toronto Food Policy Council. I was chair of it in the 90s during amalgamation, when it looked like it might go under and became instead a much bigger and better, really, organization at the scale of the new city, or of Metro. The farmers market coming in now, and they're all over the city, and community shared agriculture boxes, and always been connected to Food Share, but I never got any of their boxes because there were so many other mm-hmm. food options.
So you
here.
Do a lot of your shopping at the Karma Co-op then?
I do. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Even
I loved having little. But there,
yeah.
there, no,
yeah.
there used to be a lot more little stores. Like there was a wonderful little Italian grocery called Formusa.
Where was that?
On Bloor. Blur around. One of the sad things for me is when I lose track of what was there before, like the history of these shops when they change too much. And I have lost track of a lot on Blur Street. But it was somewhere around Albany or mm-hmm. something like that. It was on the north side of the street. And it was a really nice Italian food store, and not nearly.
So it was a grocery store?
It was a grocery store, yeah. And there was a greengrocer up there. I don't know if you ever went up there.
I don't think so.
Yeah, there was a greengrocer that had, green out on the street. So, yeah, I did a fair bit of shopping at the little shops on Bloor Street as well. Oh, and there was, of course, the Hungarian meat place.
Oh, yeah. There were several Hungarian stores.
And they had groceries as well. And my mother, when she would come up from the States to visit, we'd always go there to get the right kind of paprika so she could bring it home with her.
Was your mother Hungarian?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Lovely. So she was happy to find those Hungarian stores.
And there were all those little Hungarian restaurants. Now there's just one, country style, which is left. Right. But I can't remember the names of them now. There was the Blue Danube or something like that.
I remember I used to go buy Dobrostort. Even if I wasn't shopping, I would just give myself a couple pieces of Dobrostort.
That's really good, yeah. Or Sockertort. Yeah, oh, yeah, my.
Yeah. So there were more Hungarian establishments, mm-hmm. stores, and
restaurants.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was the name of the butcher and little grocery store?
The one on Bloor.
Yeah.
After I turn off the machine, we'll both
okay,
remember.
Okay, right. But anyway, yeah. It's not that long ago it closed, actually. Maybe 10 years. Yeah. I'm getting old. It was really sad when it closed. I used to go there a lot. Yeah.
And as you say, especially when your mother was visiting.
Yeah.
Because they had the right kind of paprika.
Yeah. The real deal.
What do you think are, globally speaking, the bigger changes, the biggest changes in the close to 40 years that you've been here?
Well, I've been describing a lot of it in the fine grain, right? I mean, there's the overall shift of class and lower density, you know, mm-hmm. that I represent.
Yes.
And toward professionals and whatever. But now there's this newer thing, which is maybe a return to the old rooming houses.
Well, I hope not.
I hope not too, but there you go. But it's interesting, you know. I mean, I've had, Sylvia said to me, when I was really upset about some of the antics going on next door, I said, there's so many of them in there, right? It's just too many people. And she said, well, you know, Nick's family, because I lived in that house, Nick's family had more people than that in there. They didn't have all their own bedroom, right? I can't remember how many sons there were, at least three, Sal, Mario, and Nick. There might have been more kids.
But it's different when you get all these individuals coming in versus a family where there are parents and values. It's not the same thing, because I know I've spoken to so many people where this house would have had really 12, 13 people.
Yes, yes.
But it was different from these. It's just not the same. Nick's family, people piled in.
Yeah, it's true. And there were, but this was an intermediate case where the family lived on the main floor, but they had roomers. Yeah. In separate rooms, and there must have been at least four or five. There were probably five.
But they still lived on that floor.
That's
and those
right.
Rumors were not
That's
going
right.
to be having noisy parties.
That's right. And actually, when the house next door was rented out and divided into two apartments, the people downstairs, who were the Filipino family that were related to the wife of the owner, or I guess she was the owner too, they kept it fine. You know, if there was a problem, I could talk to them, or probably I didn't even have to talk to them because they were on it already. They weren't going to tolerate smoke or noise, which were the two main issues. So, yeah, absolutely,
but you're right. But I agree that there were, I mean, Sylvia's right, there were many people living. I mean, these two rooms that you have here easily could have had the mother and the father and their four children and then lots of other people.
Plus one in the back. Yeah. There's one behind the kitchen.
Yeah, but certainly
yes, it's absolutely.
Different nature.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was just done at a family reunion for my father's family, and
where was that?
In Switzerland, in Zurich, and we were taken on a tour. Of where his older sister, my aunt, was born, and where he was born, and these would be Jewish immigrants from Poland to Switzerland, and before and during and after World War One, and actually before, because my father was born in 1917, And then the families that received them and the houses they were in, and then people moved a lot, but only within a certain neighborhood. And these were the Polish Jews who were different from the German Jews who had another part of town that was a little fancier. But there were, I mean, the buildings look fine, but there were a lot of people in them, a lot. And there were people who were always receiving new people. And I think it would be interesting to know if that's how the immigrants came here, if there were places where Portuguese families could come, you know, and then find their own place. But
I've certainly listened to some wonderful stories of exactly what you described. Uh-huh. You are coming, you're a member of a large family, and you'll stay here until you're established.
Yeah.
You and your two children, and then your sisters and brother.
Yeah. So, I've been very much getting in touch, and also with my students in different ways, with things I forget about being an immigrant, you know, about my family's own immigration. My immigration to Canada was completely different. So, yeah.
At what stage of your life did you come to Canada?
I came while I was still a graduate student, enrolled still in the U.S.
So you would have been your early 20s, maybe?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you spoke English?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's right.
Let's come back to your daughter. Because you lived right here on Robert, she could go to the foodist corner store, she could go to the Constant Reader.
Yeah.
Who were her friends, and what kinds of games did they play, and where did they play?
Oh, well, Lena was sometimes. It was kind of a complicated relationship, as relationships with girls can be sometimes. They went to ICS together.
What's that?
Oh, Institute of Child Study up on Walmer Road. Uh-huh. And we actually, Sylvia and I think Lena only went for maybe 1 year. Laura went for longer. When they were going together, they would actually walk together. Mm-hmm. And there was no light there, but we insisted that they go to the light either, I guess, at Brunswick and cross and come back. There was a crosswalk, but that didn't feel good enough. Since Newton's laws trump, you know, trump traffic laws. And I'm not sure they always did, but that was the promise. And they survived very well. So they would, they would actually go up to Walmer and wherever that circle is, you know, where the Institute
North
of Child...
North of Bloor.
And
so they didn't go to any of the local schools for elementary...
Lena then did. Yeah, and she went to Lord Lansdowne after. And Laura, before that, was in Palmerston School, and she was bused there for French immersion. Mm-hmm. I was very disappointed. I would have loved to send her to Lord Lansdowne just because it's a neighborhood school, and I would have sacrificed other things like French immersion. But I found out that most of the kids at Lord Lansdowne were coming from somewhere else. And so they would all disappear in the afternoon. At that point, it was very intensely Chinese.
And so they were coming from south and east.
Wherever they were coming from, it got defined as a good school to bring your kids to. And, you know, I mean, all of this was after whenever some decision was made to not require kids to go to their neighborhood school. Right? So, that's how it was going. And so I thought, well, if it's not a neighborhood school anyway, the only advantage is for her to be able to walk there. It's not going to be a friendship circle, particularly. And in fact, I think she got more of that at Palmerston, which isn't that far. And at that point, they were still dependent on parents. Well, they wouldn't have been. Like, no, Lena and Laura could go across the street. And they made a little, it wasn't a tree house exactly, but they put a little plank up between some things there, and they would sit up there sometimes, and I would, and we made a little pulley, and so I would give them some lemonade. Oh, they could get on it by, I used to have a box out there, it's not there, it's now for the recycling bin and stuff like that, so they could stand on the box and get themselves up in the tree, even without a ladder. And then we had a little rope, and I'd give them some lemonade and snacks in a basket. That was very sweet. And she had another friend that used to sell lemonade out in the front.
Were there quite a few children at that time?
Not so many. Mm-hmm. Not so many.
And what's the situation now in terms of children?
Well, and you see, and then the differences in the backgrounds of people made a huge difference too. So, for instance, the Portuguese neighbors next door had grandchildren at the same time as I had Laura. But they couldn't play together because I needed Laura to be in daycare, either before she was going to school full-time or after she was going to school for after-school care. And that was the time that they would have played, right? So, you know, was it taken...
So the grandparents took care of the grandchildren, these grandparents?
Yes, I think actually their daughter may have lived with them. Now, I mean, this is a sort of interesting thing because I did have some babysitters. There were three sisters and another Portuguese family further north on Robert Street, closer to almost at the corner, just south of Sussex. And one of those young women got pregnant before being married and kept the baby and stayed at home. And her younger sisters... They all became, and then the little boy was growing up there at least until he was six or seven. And then she and the two younger sisters would come and babysit with Laura at different times and even go pick her up sometimes from daycare if I needed that, which was rare but did happen. And it was just always an interesting...
A lot of juggling on your part.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But... Yeah, it was wonderful to have neighborhood people who, you know, worked out, you know, where it was, I don't want to say resources, because that's kind of partly true, but it was much more relational than that, you know, that it's a nice exchange. And actually, Gus does most of my renovations here, too.
For so many of us.
Yeah.
What about using front porch or veranda, whatever you call it, and back garden and the lane?
Uh-huh.
Have you used it? Has Laura used it? How have those things been used?
I used to use it a lot,
the front porch.
Now, I can't remember why I stopped, but I don't have a bench out there. I used to have a bench, and it was really easy to sit on the bench and put my feet up on the rail. Because I guess it must have been after I did this front porch and decided to put planters in there, and then this ugly old bench got moved, and I never... replaced it.
Fit in with a new...
No, I just didn't even think about it. I somehow, it's funny, I think I must have stopped using it already.
Mm-hmm. So in the 70s and 80s you did use
it? Yeah, I used to sit out there. And as far as I know, Josephine's the main one who sits out now. She'll sit on her steps and drink her coffee in the morning. And honestly, she knows everything. If I want to know anything about anybody, she's the one to ask. The back, I had that, it was just awful when I moved in. It was just asphalt parking with, was there a fence? I don't even think maybe there was a fence. No, there was no fence. It was just asphalt parking and concrete steps. And it was after someone, and there was a back door that was just wooden that led into... what was then a laundry room in the back. That was the entrance in the back.
So you had a laundry room at the back of your house here.
Yeah.
And that led onto the concrete.
Yes, and this concrete steps led out to the asphalt, which was open to the back lane. And, you know, it was... And then, so, yeah, we used it to park, and then we'd come in that way. But then I stopped having a car. Before I stopped having a car, I redid that... It was when I stopped moving upstairs. I moved into the whole house, and I redid that back area into a little garden. I can show you. It's so sweet.
Yes, I'd love to see
a little garden with a parking space. And I think partly, I don't know if I was already having water problems. I was having water problems in the basement. That was it. And the thing was angled wrong, right? So what had to happen was to reconstruct it so that the water would flow the other way. And so while I was at that, because that was fairly major, I could put it on top of the asphalt, but I didn't. They dug it up, and they used gabion baskets so they didn't have to move it away, and they built up an elevated parking space with a fence around it, and then sunken down is a nice little garden. you know,
with
little wooden steps that go down. And then at some point after that, I think, I can't remember if it was before or after, there was a break-in through that door. And so I replaced it with a steel door.
Wow. Yeah.
But the whole frame around it was really falling down, and I knew it alerted me to the necessity at some point of rebuilding that little extension where the laundry room was, and then Gus did that. So now it's a bathroom, and the laundry's upstairs. It's a bathroom and a pantry, and there's no door there. But before that, in an earlier renovation, I'd had a sliding door put out when I made the garden and stuff. So it feels pretty safe. I'm not overly concerned. I used to use the back laneway a lot to walk my dog, mm-hmm. but he's gone to another plane now. And
is it paved, the back lane?
Yeah.
And was it always paved as long as you've been
mm-hmm.
here?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And was it used by the children at all that you recall, or was it just
cars? Oh, well, I helped it be used by the children because,
yeah.
It's a good question, because in one of all of those things, some workman here, out of some conversation, put up a basketball thing, yeah, with a hoop, you know, he I think it was when he was building the fence, so he kind of attached it somehow to that. So then a lot of people started using, of different ages, at different times of day, started using it.
So not only your family, but
yeah
the kids, and
yeah.
it drew the kids from the neighborhood.
Yeah. But then, I can't remember, it started getting really noisy. When I didn't want it to be, basketball can be.
Yeah.
And Laura was long gone, so I just, and I needed to rebuild the fence, so it was time for it to go.
So there was a period when that was an active spot.
Yeah.
It's a narrow lane back there, I think. Is that quite a narrow
lane? It's fairly narrow. Yeah. So, yeah, getting into that parking space, because there's a light pole there, too, it can be pretty tricky.
I want to come back to this. You mentioned several times when you used to have a car and you no longer have a car.
Right.
I'd like you to talk about how you made that decision, when...
Oh, it was growing on me that I really didn't want to have a car. And there were certain... my daughter was grown up. When you have a kid, it's usually convenient to have a car. Now, what I didn't say when I was talking about her independence was that when she got old enough to use the subway, she had a lot more freedom of the city. You know, and this was before cell phones. And I remember... insisting that she use some of her friends' cell phones to call me, I knew where she was and stuff. But yeah, it was great. And she didn't get a driver's license until she was in her 20s. My father wanted to give her a car. I said, well, if you give her a car, you can give her a car parking space to go with it.
don't have a parking space back here anymore.
I do.
Oh, you
actually
still do.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
And I let, you know, when I have visitors, or if I sometimes I belong to Auto Share,
uh-huh.
So
uh-huh.
you know, occasionally it's used for something.
But you're not driving.
How did
you come to that?
Well, there were different stages. I had a really crazy freak accident where I wasn't hurt, but the car was just about demolished and that was when I realized I really want this car, or any car, but I figured, well, even to sell it, I have to get it fixed. But then I thought, well, maybe if I used it, I could just get it kind of fixed up a little bit, you know, like they do in the third world. And I don't know, but everyone treated me like I was really crazy to do that. And then there was this other, but I did. I got it fixed properly, and I guess insurance covered it or whatever. And then it was stolen. It was stolen from right in front here. Oh no! Before it was stolen, it was a red neon. Now there's a long history to why it was a red neon. I wouldn't have chosen either the color or the brand, but a series of things. Anyway, that's what it was, and that apparently the police told me attracted people, including accidents, apparently statistically red cars. And anyway, so before that, someone broke the window, and I called the police because I needed to do it for the insurance, right? And I said, well, now, why would they break the window of this car? And they said, they figure you have Ray-Ban glasses in there. And I went, oh, just going, you know, that's, it's not me, but that's apparently.
So you had all these little pieces of glass on your front seat.
Oh, I can't remember. I can't remember. Mess. But, you know, you can't, you need a window in your car. So I had to get that fixed. Then I had this accident. And, then I had the accident. I got it fixed. Then it was stolen. All of this went on over a number of years, right? It wasn't one thing after another. Then it was stolen, and it was stolen from the front, from the street here. And, you know, sometimes I forget where I park it, you know, and so my first thought isn't always it's stolen. But I was standing on the front step, and I saw it wasn't there, and I just knew it was stolen. And my first thought was so revealing. It was, I guess I have to tell the police. I was like happy it was gone. I was like, good riddance to this car. Well, of course, the police found it, and they'd taken it for a joyride, and so it kind of smelled of alcohol and stuff, but it was not in bad shape, except they'd broken, they'd had to start it, so they'd broken the ignition. So I thought, someone showed me you could just stick your finger, I could stick my finger in the same way they did and start the car. The problem was theft, so I thought, well, maybe I could just get one of those bars that lock it, you know, and I wouldn't have to fix that. And everyone just treated me like I was totally crazy, because I just felt like it was such a burden. Like, I don't want to take care of this the way I take care of my house, you know? And that this, it was so revealing how relieved I was,
that it was gone. To get rid of it.
But the moment of realization was, I was walking along Bloor Street, in fact, up this little alleyway next to Madoko, and I ran into a former student. She had just finished, and she had done her thesis research. She was a PhD student. I'd supervised it on money, on how people do alternative currencies, how people negotiate prices when you don't use the market, and especially the gender dimensions. It was a brilliant thesis, really interesting. She knew all this about money in this deep way and so on. And I just ran into her and I said, this is the first time I'd had the thought. It came out of my mouth. I said, I'm gonna sell my car. And she called me up later and she said, I'd like to buy your car. I said, no, you can't have it, it's bad karma. She said, I've thought about that, and I've decided it's not the car's karma, it's your karma, and I want to buy it, and I want to figure out a fair price for it. And I said, okay, but you have to do all the work to figure out the price. I'm not. So she did. And she got the most interesting set of responses. People said, this is not what you do. You pay as little as possible, and she asks as much as possible, and then you come to her. No, she says, no, I want to come up with a fair price. And she talked to dealers, and she looked at books and, you know, websites or whatever, and she came up with a price, explained it all to me, told me many of these interesting stories, and I said, fine. So she took
she
it.
She said, no, it's not the car, it's your car.
Well, she had a great time with it.
So she bought that rig.
Yeah, took it to St. Catharines, and eventually, she had it for years, and then eventually she gave it to her sister somewhere in northern Ontario. So it's still going somewhere. So, yeah.
And how has that worked for you?
Great. I never regretted it the only nanoseconds where I regretted it were with AutoShare, when I had to be much better at planning. Because if you book it for a certain amount of time, you really do have to return it then. Now, you can extend it if nobody wants it, but you have to remember to do that. And if somebody wants it, it's extremely inconvenient, and you can't do it very many times if you're unlucky and somebody wants it. But that actually doesn't happen too often. I'm getting better at planning it, or just booking extra time. And also, there are many more cars, and because of this, their fleet has increased, and this neighborhood is so well served. There's no shortage for me, and I see they're in use. You know, I walk by their places, and they're.
And so, how do you usually get from place A to place B?
Bicycle. I do a lot of cycling. TTC, taxis. This is, to me, taxis are the urban car, right? They're there for, you know, you don't have to park. You're like a princess. They pick you up and they drop you off. Now, it works because we're in a big city, so you can hail a taxi when you're downtown or in most places. And it's such a luxury. And you can take so many taxis for the amount you pay to keep a car. You know, AutoShare has done some of those calculations of how much, you know, it costs to run a car. The insurance maintenance. Of course, once you have the car, then it's the cheapest thing to do, usually,
to use it, yeah.
Right? Because it's the fixed cost. But if you don't put those fixed costs in, you can live a very luxurious life, in my view.
And that door-to-door service.
Absolutely. Yeah. Meet interesting people.
So you have conversations with the drivers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I recruit them for farming, for world crops, you know, because a lot of them are astrophysicists, right, who are driving taxis and they grew up on a farm, or some of them are agronomists and they're driving taxis and it never occurred to them because they're so far from the countryside that, you know, somebody from Pakistan might have grown peaches, wheat, sheep. Like, you can do that here. You can't automatically do it, but that's what farmers have always done here. So, yeah.
So they say, watch out for this white-haired woman if she gets into your car.
Oh, I can't tell you how many people I've given numbers and websites to. Most of them aren't. You know, I don't raise it with everybody, but if they seem at all interested. So, yeah, I turn it into part of my kind of political work in the city, my way of living.
And they have an interesting 20 minutes with you.
Oh, and I learn a lot from them. Yeah. It may not be about that, maybe about something else. Yeah.
So you are very comfortable using AutoShare occasionally and using all these other bike ways.
Walk is good. Yeah. I mean, there's so much you can do on foot in this neighborhood. I even get a little conservative, you know, like there are days when I don't have to go anywhere outside of 4 or 5 blocks, right? Or even 2.
And then you walk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's one of the advantages most of us love about this. Mm-hmm. I love that about this neighborhood.
Absolutely.
I even walked all the way to your house.
Oh, really?
You know, 4 minutes.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I think that we've pretty well touched on most of what I wanted to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
When you knew that I was coming, did you have any thoughts about what you might want to talk about living in the neighborhood, the changes, your experiences?
Yeah. One thing I might add, because it fits with a lot of these other pieces, is that when I moved downstairs, I had the basement had the bathroom, and it had a finished room where those women had been working, but it hadn't been used for anything, really. Well, it had been used when it was rented out as an apartment. In fact, it had been used as a bedroom. But I turned that into an apartment. I put a little kitchen unit in there, and it doesn't have a separate entrance. And I bartered that apartment for extra child care. So Laura was, like babysitting nights or sometimes if I want. Because I travel a lot for my work, too. And that was a wonderful arrangement.
So it's a win-win.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you would interview them very carefully, and they would understand that there was a
child. I didn't usually have to interview much. The Toronto Women's Bookstore. That was such an asset to this neighborhood. And in those, for most of the time, and certainly all the time I was renting, they had a housing file. A housing file. And so I would go and put my ad only there. Only in the Toronto Women's Bookstore housing file. And the people who looked in there and came to me were usually great.
I didn't know that. I mean, I wasn't renting anything out, but I didn't know that that existed.
Well, that's part of the community thing here. And that it was, you know, even though the Toronto Women's Bookstore was the only, as far as I know, the only one in the city, and drew all over the city, it was a neighborhood place. In that way.
So before I turn this off, I wonder whether you might talk a little more about the neighborhood here. You've talked about the neighbors right across the street and the sometimes difficult neighbors that you share a wall with.
Right.
But the feeling of neighborhood.
Well, a lot of the stores, I mean, Hutoshi's been here for ages. I can't remember when she moved in, but I know that she did after I did, and then that's changed. You know, so she's moved to the back now. When Momo's moved in, and now it's going. Oh, my goodness. I remember Mohammed coming and knocking on my door to sign a petition that it would be all right to have a commercial establishment there. And that was a great asset to the neighborhood. And it came when the Paretta's stopped being so much of a neighborhood place. In fact, eventually it stopped being Paretta's. When the laundromat that used to be where the psychology bookstore is now, Cabershams, mm-hmm. when that closed and the psychology bookstore moved in, I knew some tipping point had been reached because people didn't need a laundromat and there was room for another bookstore, right? Yeah, yeah. It used to be a dentist that was above there. So there were a lot more services on Harvard Street, and then, you know, in addition to the shops.
Services for people who had less.
Yes.
And then it became, that's part of the gentrification, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Although I don't know about a dentist, and now there's a psychologist or psychiatrist that's moved in where the Morgenthaler Clinic used to be, right? In that space that wasn't rented for a very long time. Ms. Emma was there, and then finally it got rented too. So that's, I don't know if that's different from a dentist. You know, certainly it's the kind of dentist office that was upstairs that probably people here wouldn't go to now. We'd want something a little classier. But the laundromat, for sure, although there is one over on Lippincott, I think, still, Lippincott and Ulster, or Borden and Ulster, something like that.
Oh, well, it's between Brunswick. Yeah, Brunswick and Borden.
Yeah, I think it's at Lippincott, whatever it is. And then all these fancy restaurants. The corner store has stayed here, and it's transformed, and now it has the flowers, and, you know, and it's become better. And everyone who's been there, there was a bit of rapid turnover for a while, and it was frustrating, but then the present people really settled in and made it theirs. And so things like, they change their stock, so if you ask for anything, I found, they'll bring it in. And if it doesn't work, they don't keep it. But they introduce us to, Tim Grant introduced me to these Korean popsicles, melon bars, that are so nice. But they'll also bring in, you know, organic eggs and milk, if that's what we want.
So they're very responsive to the neighborhood.
Absolutely, yeah. And then, so they've been great, and the Harvard Bakery has evolved with the neighborhood. But most of the other things have changed, I would say. I can't think of anything else in this end of Harvard Street or even on Harvard Street at all. Even Pizza Gigi, I remember moving in there. The things across from Central Tech, they take their own character. But just around here, the university, and it was changes in the university. So I think it's probably because of the university that all of these more high-end restaurants have been able to move in, because I mean it's way too many for this neighborhood to support just like this, even though we do, right? When they open, when they close, there's usually a group that comes. And
well, and people come from other neighborhoods,
they
to
do
eat in our
they do they do but it's hard to know what's cause and what's effect, like why did they move in here. And my guess is my experience at the university was we started a lot more elaborate recruiting. And not just, you know, all the departments. And so that involved dinners and lunches and so on. And so I think that kind of provided a
base. So that's been one of the effects of the university on this neighborhood.
I think so.
Any other thoughts about the university right on our doorstep?
Well, it's good news and bad news, right? You know, so now they're going to build more of these residences for... that they're not even restricting to students, so these unattached young people, and it intersects with the changes in the whole economy with youth unemployment. And I wish that weren't so, but I'm not sure. I think accommodating them in this way in this neighborhood is going to solve the problem. So it's a very, very complex question between personal and global kind of perspectives. I really don't like some of the architecture that graduate student has, but you can, I can, I, there it is, you know. The athletic center is a great asset, although I have to say I don't use it. I even belong, and I'm not using it. I'm going to stop belonging because I see I'm not using it. Yeah, I think the expansion of the university is a real problem, both the way it's expanding and the fact of the expansion, you know, so the land part and the number of students. And it's a problem for the university itself. It's a problem for me as a teacher in university. So it's hard for me to distinguish it because it's been incredibly convenient. When I was teaching my geography classes, I could be in class in under 5 minutes from my house, you know? Like, how could I be more privileged? You know, I couldn't even ride my bike any faster, you know? At the same, when I went out to Arundale, I would take the bus. There's a direct bus from Central Campus.
Oh, from campus to campus.
From campus to campus, yeah. So, I mean, if you missed the bus, it was a problem, but, you know, yeah. It was good for my chronological challenges.
You're saying it's a real mixed bag, university being art.
Yeah. And for me, it's all entwined with the university as my employer and the neighbor, right? The neighbor of the institution in the neighborhood.
So there's not a simple answer.
No. But I mean, in general, I think having the bookstores and the, you know, a lot of the institutions that come with an academic setting has been mostly good. So bars and some of that. But that's partly accompanied a change in student culture too, I think.
Meaning that there's a different in the nature of the students or the...
Yeah, and you know, and my daughter's been explaining this to me. She's been astute. She went to McGill, which isn't any different. All universities that I know of have been going through this. It's a generational and cohort kind of phenomenon in conjunction with larger economic changes and changes in universities themselves. That could get us into a very long story, but. Yes, I think there is a change in student culture, and it's, on the whole, not for the best in terms of intellectual engagement, so that the ones who do want to do that find themselves swimming more against the stream of their colleagues. Right? They're always good students, and they're always intellectually engaged people.
But you're saying that could... That's part of
the party
of the university being so close to us, or we're so close to the university.
It's part of the effect on us,
yes.
The change in student culture. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more partying, and there's a lot more of the motivation of being part of student life in a social way that's not deeply attached to the intellectual part
well,
of it.
That's a whole other long conversation that you and I can have.
Yeah. You only teach graduates, professional
master's
students.
Degree students.
People who are
they're
there for a reason.
Well, Harriet Friedman, what is today? Is the 8th of August. I forgot to mention it earlier.
Uh-huh.
I want to say thank you very much. This has been a pleasure for me to listen to your experiences and your description and perception. So thank you very, very
much. Well, thank you. It's been actually fun going over it all.